Okay, so I wasn't, again, I wasn't sort of entirely sure how to structure this next bit. So what I decided to do was to kind of treat it as if it was one of our undergraduate seminars and make it quite interactive in terms of what we're going to do. So partly kind of group discussion and partly maybe kind of slightly smaller groups kind of going off to do some close reading and then coming back. So trying to make it quite engaging, I guess. So we'll start with L'Allegro and Il Penseroso. So I had planned for about an hour session. So hopefully people don't have to dash off right at 9. I decided to privilege Epic and Paradise Lost over the earlier poetry, but we're still going to look a bit at the earlier stuff. So I guess I wanted to start with quite a glib question about, like, which world would people like to inhabit, right?
Which world?
Which lifestyle is preferable? The world of the lively man or the world of the reflective man?
Lively.
Or neither. So I was kind of intrigued to see if people had a leaning for one, perhaps over the other, an affinity for one over the other, or not.
I think the reflective man had a nice, calm time. I find that quite attractive, actually.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it's quite a
at the end,
gentle
poem. Comes out, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Well, now I'm older, you see, I rather enjoy Il Penseroso. But
yeah.
I mean, I am actually in love lyric poetry, and I absolutely love that the way he uses the sounds and the words and the language in Allegro.
Yeah.
And the rhythms and the way that sort of it leads on.
Yeah. It's astonishingly beautiful poetry. I mean, if I'm allowed to say it, I gave you these two poems partly because they're so pretty, right? Mm. And beautifully constructed pieces of poetry. Mm. So, yeah, I mean...
And not too long.
No, that's the other thing. I'd forgotten, actually, how brief some of Milton's earlier poetry is, which is good. So I guess I thought we could throw some ideas up on the board of the sorts of imagery, ideas and aspects from each world that jumped out at people. Ultimately, perhaps working as binaries, potentially, so one comes out of one poem, might be matched with something coming out of, so something come out of L'Allegro may be matched with something from Il Penseroso. They are twinned in many ways. So I thought I'd split the board in half and kind of see what ideas people were going to kind of come up with for the two poems. Okay, so imagery, words, themes, ideas that you feel come out of one or other or both.
There were birds.
Yes.
There's the lark in the merry one, and
yes,
the nightingale in the reflective.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Oh, sorry, giving away my next question. Yep. Why? Why? What's the kind of effect of that lark and nightingale?
Well, nightingale is the evening.
Yeah.
And
yeah. So very much kind of a kind of bird-like representation of day and night, or at least light and dark. That kind of binary that comes out of the two poems, I think.
Yeah, day and night. That's right. That's what I was going to say.
What else? People feel. Think.
You both mention oak trees.
Yeah.
Very sense of strength.
Yeah.
flowers, aren't they?
Yep.
Again, across both.
Colours. Flowers and colours.
Yeah. Do people get a sense of colour across both being different, perhaps?
Yes.
Sort
of. Saffron lamps and that brown ale.
Yeah. There's a lot of kind of, I mean, I guess kind of going with this kind of rustic. Pastoral, and I'm kind of tying in with what we talked about in the lecture as well, I guess. That deliberate kind of evoking of colour for L'Allegro in particular that Milton does through Mirth's kind of parentage, I guess. Any other binaries between the two poems that people noticed?
There's noises as well.
Yeah.
Music isn't there in L'Allegro or something.
Does the light come into it, perhaps?
Yeah.
Sun.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a very kind of daytime L'Allegro and a much more nighttime.
Yeah.
I mean, the poem starts. Il Penseroso talks about they kind of almost have to sort of like dim the light in order to see melancholy, right? In order for her to emerge, if you like. Any other binaries that kind of came out?
What about active things, the activities that go on?
Yes. Yeah.
There's very much, there's dancing and...
Yeah.
And I know there's a lovely little line about the bee with its thigh filled with honey.
Yeah.
And I have a feeling that comes up in both, does it?
Yes, definitely in Il Penseroso. Interesting kind of activity. So I think L'Allegro's, well, unsurprising, right? Lively versus reflective. It's a poem that's kind of out and about walking around and kind of seeing nature and seeing farming. And Il Penseroso, he's sort of sat around, well, he's reading, he's napping, he's pensive, right?
Yes, absolutely.
Anything else that I was keen, I think the easiest way for us to kind of to think about both was to think about them as Milton did, as interconnected poems, as a pair. Any other binaries, any other kind of things of parallel that you see coming out of one and being reflected in the other?
I think like peace, quiet, care.
Yeah. Yeah.
And another one, but I can't remember which one it was. So.
Yeah. Anything else? I think I left my list in my office. I guess there are two broader binaries that are quite important. One in terms of the genre of the kind of texts that are referenced in the two. So comedy comes out of L'Allegro, so there's quite a lot of talk about Shakespeare, talk a lot of like Ben Jonson, and tragedy. Not to say that it's supposed to be some sort of like tragic poem, but kind of dwelling more on the nature of the genre of kind of tragic writing, and kind of engaging with those, and kind of calls up, he kind of expresses a wish that he could talk to some of these poets that have kind of created some of these more tragical works, if you like. So a comedy and tragedy kind of binary. And there was another one, and I've forgotten it.
Yes, because I was looking at sometime that gorgeous tragedy incepted. Incepted all comes sweeping by.
Yeah.
Il Penseroso.
Yeah. Ah, I remembered the other one. Classical and Christian. being dealt with in quite interesting ways across the two poems. How did people feel that Milton kind of accommodated? I'll write that up and then I can sit down. Some of these are a little glib, but the kind of gist is there, I guess. How did you feel Milton, because it's pertinent for kind of what we're going to talk about with Paradise Lost, how did you feel Milton kind of accommodated the classical and the Christian elements across the two poems and across the two kind of modes of living, if you like?
Much about Christian stuff in La Lettre, is there?
No.
It's much easier to spot classical references.
Yeah, absolutely.
I agree.
The speaker's talk of a nun in a Penserosa.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the goddess in Il Penso, or you find the start of the poem. It's divinest melancholy that Milton is engaging with in Il Penseroso. And he describes her as a nun. He says, "Come, pensive nun, devout and pure, sober, steadfast and demure." Il Penseroso has a more... It's far more Christian than L'Allegro. As you say, the references are much easier to spot in the second poem. What other things did kind of like throw it over to you guys? What sorts of things did you find interesting? What sort of things were you keen to sort of chat about?
The interesting thing for me was the fact that it compares the active and contemplative life,
yeah,
which was quite a feature of discussion in the Renaissance. And the contemplative life was usually in a cloister.
Mm.
So that's probably where the religious side comes in, although Milton wasn't Catholic.
Mm.
But the idea is that someone who's contemplative is... studies religion, perhaps.
Yeah.
Or reads.
Yeah.
Anyway, reads the Bible, say.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. The person in L'Allegro is pretty busy doing other things.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Again, yes. To kind of be a little flip about it, but not bad things.
No.
Milton's not presenting a binary of like frivolity. Yeah. And, you know, the right kind of life. He's presenting, he's partly presenting two modes of living. He's particularly presenting two modes of being a poet, right? Two ways of thinking, two frames of reference, if you like. What else? How did you? I've got another question. How did you feel the two? I guess we've kind of been talking about it already. But what thoughts did you come, if any thoughts did you come to the session with about how these two work together? How they sit as a pair?
Well, they're nicely juxtaposed, aren't they? They do sit nicely as a pair. It's like, almost like a double portrait.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's a kind of lovely way of thinking about it. Absolutely. Yeah. Any other thoughts about them being twinned here?
Yes, I didn't think of that.
Well, they kind of sit in conjunction with each other.
I didn't think of that.
No.
I thought very much, oh, they're different.
Yeah.
And they're contrasts.
But I think what you're saying is most fascinating. I feel I need to sit down and put your fingers to it.
Well, it could be the start of, you know, a passion for Milton, right?
Well, I love the way he uses language.
Yes. Wonderful. Yeah.
The images are great, aren't they?
When you said his training and what his education was, what a beginning. Wow.
What kind of formidable person. I wouldn't want to meet him in the... Well, you probably wouldn't meet him in the pub. But, I mean, can you imagine? He'd be good on your quiz team, I think, in terms of, extensive knowledge, but...
Formidable.
Yeah, absolutely. A very formidable kind of guy. Not necessarily the most popular person. Debates as to how well-liked Milton was at Cambridge. Discussions about various bits of writing that have remained can be read either as a slight at his fellow students that he feels kind of ostracised, or in true kind of literary criticism as a joke. Because he's well liked enough that everyone can kind of view this as a joke that, you know, that he isn't ostracised at all. But yeah, an interesting character. I guess we can think for a little bit. I mean, one of the tasks that I thought might be quite nice would. But I was keen for people, if they felt it was kind of at their fingertips enough, to kind of pull out a line that really kind of spoke to them. Because I feel like I often do this with the students, but for poetry in particular, it's...
I felt the Allegro was sensual. I think there's a sensuality about it that wasn't in the other one.
Yeah.
It's more intimate.
The ending of Il Penseroso is much more like evoking a sort of traditional religious atmosphere,
ecstasy
and the afterlife.
Yeah, absolutely. Anyone got a line they feel sort of speaks to them in some way? I mean, poetry, your kind of gut feeling about something is really important with poetry, I think.
It's probably the most trivial bit, but it's in L'Allegro. Sport that wrinkled care derides, and laughter holding both his sides. Come and trip it as you go on the light, but I know this is well known, on the light fantastic toe. It's just beautiful. It sort of sparkles along.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. A lovely kind of... personification of laughter and sport. Yeah. I don't know. In my head, that feels quite an apt.
It's sort of like dancing, isn't it?
Yes.
It is.
Any other lines that people feel an affinity for?
The pastoral side of it, when he says about how very mad the junkets eat. She was pinched and pulled, she said, by the friar's lantern led. Tells how the drudging goblins swept to Ernie's cream bowl duly set. When in one night, a glimpse of morn, his shadowy flail hath threshed the corn. That 10-day labour is, sorry, could not end.
Is that a reference to Spencer, the fairy man?
Which line is it?
Page 142, this one.
So Fairy Mab, Queen of the Fairies. I don't know how this one's glossed it, if it has. This is glossed it, that it's Mab in Johnson's Entertainment at Althorp. So a character from Ben Jonson. But you get Mab in Romeo and Juliet as well.
Yeah, it's kind of Shakespearean, isn't it? This is very
Shakespearean. Yes.
There are
Spencerian references, if you like. So on line 10, 11, 12, he says, he's describing Euphrosyne, and he says, in heaven, yclept. Yclept. That's very kind of Spencerian, like a way of kind of like called. Spencer often has this kind of like weirdly archaic way of writing.
What does that mean? Can I ask?
Called.
Named. Oh, okay.
And you get eclept in Spencer. So, I guess another reason I kind of picked these was it's a tissue of all kinds of things, very much classical, but also very much English literary as well. So I thought that would be nice. I think obviously people know about Shakespeare, some people may know about Spencer. So both Milton using the classical, but also very much riffing off famous vernacular writing of the time, or just before. Spencer famously, Elizabethan poet.
Could I just ask, who would have read these poems? What was the market?
Yeah, so I mean, literacy kind of increases as the early modern period goes on. Literacy, just because you can, even if you can't read, doesn't mean you won't necessarily be exposed to literature. Whilst lots, a vast swathe of the population may not be able to read, that doesn't mean that they wouldn't have been exposed to popular literature. You only need one person in your town or your village to be able to read and to get hold of something for vast numbers of people to have exposure to it. That's a very kind of important fact for the early modern period. Ultimately, this is... Milton has these works printed, and again, print has increased at this point. It's not such a new technology, really, anymore, and quite a large amount of stuff is produced. So lots of people would have access to printed texts. We were talking in the break, like, who reads these things is often the million-dollar question. Certainly, an educated readership. You only have to look at how it is a tissue of particularly classical references to know that Milton is clearly writing for... fairly educated audience. It's very much a reflection on himself, though, as well.
If there was just the one person in the town, though, who read, how would that readership, be shared? Would they be groups, or...?
There's still quite an oral culture that goes on. So people read aloud. I guess literacy rates are sometimes hard to figure out because there's not always... there isn't a parallel necessarily between reading and writing. So someone could read but wouldn't necessarily be able to write. So sometimes then that person's readership is lost to us, I guess, because those people who write, we could sort of often annotate their texts, and so you know they've read. So I guess sometimes we don't know if people read stuff, because there isn't always a kind of and there isn't an easy mapping. You could read, but just because you could read doesn't mean that you could write.
Interesting.
Can I just ask a small detail, please? On page 143, line 132, if Johnson's learned sock be on, which is lovely. Was that just a joke of his, or was that an expression that was common?
So I can refer you for the pithy definition to the, I don't know if you've got it, the gloss at the bottom of the page that sums it up nicely for you. So it's the mark of the comic actor on the Greek and Roman stage.
Sorry. Yeah.
I feel like I can just read that to you and
yes, it's
but nicely expressed in a way that is pithier than my explanation, I guess. But I guess inherently that's kind of, again, that's a melding of Johnson and the classical in that turn of phrase, I guess. Okay. I feel like I want to drag you away from these because I want to be more kind of explicit about Milton and the ancient world. We will. We only have an hour. Ultimately, we could have 3 hours on these two poems, right? And it would be lovely to almost go through them line by line and see the kind of how the imagery is working here. Do spend some time with these poems. They're beautiful. And perhaps go away and see them twinned now. And kind of map it together. Map it yourself. One will shed light on the other. And the two work together in really kind of nice ways, I think. Okay, so in the absence of asking you in advance of this session to read the Iliad, the Odyssey, the Aeneid, and Paradise Lost, I felt the best way to kind of engage all of those things, which are really important for Milton, was via giving you the openings of all of them. It's a little reductionist, but in many ways, some of the most important things of epic poetry happens at the start. That works nicely for this session, I guess.
I enjoyed having those three, and I think I began to get a feeling that this was showing us what the basic, you know, there's a great hero, and there's an introduction to what is going to happen.
Yeah.
It was good.
Yeah. I kind of wanted you to see. I wanted you to kind of have read a bit of all of them for them, at sort of on their own merit. Equally, I wanted you to have built up a picture as much as you can about sort of one specific bit of epic. So in this case, the opening, and then how Milton kind of riffs off that, incorporates those, and does something unique or different. So, what I thought we'd do, kind of encouraging you to pick a little bit of some of it apart, if you were willing, I thought maybe you could split into three groups, and each group could have a little reminder of one of the openings in particular, and come back and kind of slightly pick it apart for us.
Yes.
If you can remember some of the kind of epic features, so I can pull them up. I can get them up for you to see. Here we are. I'll kind of jump between these two slides for your use to see if you can pull out any of the kind of conventions of epic. Would people be willing to do that?
Yeah.
Is that okay?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm happy for you to kind of divide yourselves as you wish into three. So basically, we'll have covered one group can do the Iliad, one can do the Odyssey, and one can do the Aeneid. So I've got some questions. What's the subject matter of your poem? What's the point of the epic? Any kind of epic conventions that you think you might have noticed? And to do kind of what I just asked you to do with the earlier poetry, pull something out that speaks to you, that's kind of striking, that engages you in some way. And you might democratically kind of decide on a line together, or kind of pick a couple, it's up to you. I was thinking earlier, do you know roughly sort of how you're going to split yourselves?
Where we're sitting.
Three.
Yeah,
three.
Yeah.
Four.
Does anyone have a strong preference for one of them? No? Okay, so if we go, you guys have a look at the Iliad.
Okay.
If you guys have to look at the Odyssey, and then you guys look at the Aeneid. I feel like I should give the people doing the Iliad. I was sitting in my office earlier and I felt like I needed to... I didn't need to do it with the others, but I felt that because you're not going to carry on and read the rest of the poem and the whole in media res thing, actually scuppered you a little bit to do this, because you don't kind of know... you don't understand why Achilles is angry. You don't understand why this man has turned up. Who is Chryseis, right? Yes. It was striking the others don't have that same problem. So for you, the Achaeans, so the Greeks, went and sacked like a nearby town, and they took two women as their spoils of war. So they took Chryseis and Briseis as kind of like spoils of war, basically. And Agamemnon took Chryseis, and Achilles took Briseis. Now, Chryseis' father comes to the Greek camp, and that you see in these opening lines. And he offers a big ransom for her return, and Agamemnon basically like sends him away, poo-poos him. So he appeals to Apollo, who listens, and Apollo sends plague down upon the Greek camp. And what you don't see, and which is quite important for you, I think, is that Agamemnon eventually gives in and gives her back, but under the condition that he gets Briseis instead. So he takes Briseis off Achilles, and that's what this is all about, okay? That's why Achilles is angry, because Agamemnon's taken his woman, right? And so he just refuses to fight in the Trojan War. And that's a big part of the Iliad. So that's a little bit of contextual information that you need.
Thank you.
Okay. So what is your subject matter? There might be one line that you feel kind of sums that up. Any kind of epic features and anything that you find striking that you want to talk about. Okay? So sort of have a chat amongst yourselves for 5 or 10 minutes. Okay? Do you want me to tip the slide over?
It's
only an episode.
On the Greeks.
Description.
So where is that?
Where you said
Odysseus
is trying to return home, isn't he?
Yes.
It's a heroic story.
Yes, heroic.
Even so, he could not save his companions.
Yeah,
all
these great difficulties. I've forgotten
that they devoured the oxen. I just remembered reading it.
So
the features are use of descriptions, extensive descriptions and similes.
They
wanted Carthage.
Carthage, yeah.
Be wide ranging.
It's hard to say. Yeah.
for years.
It might even, for you guys doing the Iliad, it might even be easier if you just restrict yourself to the first seven lines, like the first paragraph.
That would be easier.
I'm reading quite hard.
Yeah, it's very dense. It's very dense very quickly.
It is. Yeah.
And to be honest, you'll get as much from that first paragraph.
I don't know whether at the end of the script. Sorry,
I'm still annoyed about the judgment.
It phrases things. Just it.
It's the spear.
The line. 90 or 900. I don't know.
So the well, I suppose the big thing is the first line. You've got why the problem exists.
The anger.
The anger.
Yes.
Yes.
What a huge task it was. Yes, this is the story of how it was done. I suppose the
held in their multitudes to the House of Pages.
And the homecoming of
people. So it's involving a lot of people. It's not a small thing.
No. Quite cool. Gave their bodies to the deck. To be the deck.
The feasting of dogs.
The birds.
Stars.
And Zeus.
Should we say should we stretch it down to 5 minutes then, so you're not feeling too much? Is that gonna make it worse?
I'm back.
Sorry.
It's quite
much.
Really.
Yeah. At that time, division of conflict.
On line 32, remember Lord when remembering him is kept now before the
mortal thing. I don't know if it's really an impact of God, but one, two, three, four, six.
Yeah, it's the same.
Six.
And the gods say, no, it's not the will of Zeus, it's not us.
He's satisfied the gods. I suppose the gods were always interacting like one of the words of silence, like
she makes it difficult for him.
Yes, and I think the other thing is there's always this brilliant one hero to introduce to Achilles.
Well, he is mentioned twice.
Right at the first page.
Yeah,
the first
line and the
third page. It's his anger that's
beginning at the end. So that it's something about.
It's quite a bit. We'll say two more minutes and then we'll come back together. We'll work through them. So don't feel you have to have done anything exhaustive.
This is
all
here, isn't it? It is the earthen serpent. I hear every relentless nurses a grudge because it's a
side effect.
Well, that's right, and that's why he was happy to. Maybe knew who was married to us when
they're not talking about a little
child.
A whole other world.
What about the calling her a new Paris
But then they turn sympathetic to Odysseus.
To
immune.
Very few words.
So there's a
Saturnian genius.
Work out his homecoming.
Yeah. So then they reevaluate
the situation.
So he shall put away his anger.
By the Greeks.
Okay, right. We'll pause there and kind of hear how you got on. I'm not necessarily expecting anything exhaustive. Really just the kind of the gist. What is established in these opening lines? And whether anything kind of formulaically epic jumped out at you. So we'll kind of work through them. And I'm aware time is marching on, and the culmination is going to be Milton, right, at the end of this. We're going to look at Paradise Lost. So we'll think fairly swiftly about these openings then. So, I can find the start. We'll look at the Iliad first. So, I'll very quickly kind of read some of it aloud, just to refresh everybody else's mind. And we'll kind of hear what you have to say. So, seeing goddess, the anger of Peleus' son Achilles, and its devastation, which put pains thousandfold upon the Achaeans, hurled in their multitudes to the house of Hades strong souls of heroes, but gave their bodies to be the delicate feasting of dogs, of all birds, and the will of Zeus was accomplished since that time when first there stood in the vision of conflict Atreus' son, the lord of men, and brilliant Achilles. What god was it then set them together in bitter collision? Zeus's son and Leto's, Apollo, who in anger at the king drove the foul pestilence along the host, and the people perished. Since Atreus's son, that's Agamemnon, had dishonoured Chryses, priest of Apollo, when he came beside the far ships of the Achaeans to ransom back his daughter, carrying gifts beyond count and holding in his hands, wound on a staff of gold, the ribbons of Apollo, who strikes from afar and supplicated all the Achaeans. But above all, Atreus's two sons, the marshals of the people. Sons of Atreus and you other strong-grieved Achaeans, to you may the gods grant who have their homes on Olympus, Priam city to be plundered, and a fair homecoming thereafter. But may you give me back my own daughter and take the ransom, giving honour to Zeus's son who strikes from afar Apollo. Then all the rest of the Achaeans cried out in favour that the priest be respected and the shining ransom be taken. Yet this pleased not the heart of Atreus' son Agamemnon, but harshly he drove him away with a strong order upon him. Never let me find you again, old sir, near our hollow ships, neither lingering now nor coming again hereafter, for fear your staff and the god's ribbons help you no longer. The girl I will not give back. Sooner will old age come upon her in my own house, in Argos, far from her own land, going up and down by the loom and being in my bed as my companion. So go now, do not make me angry, so you will be safer. So he spoke, and the old man in terror obeyed him and went silently away beside the murmuring sea beach. Over and over the old man prayed as he walked in solitude to King Apollo, whom Leto of the lovely hair bore. Hear me, Lord of the Silver Bow, who set your power about Chryse and Killer the Sacrosanct, who are Lord in strength over Tenedos. Smintheus, if ever it pleased your heart that I built your temple, if ever it pleased you that I burned all the rich thigh pieces of bulls of goats, then bring to pass this which I pray for. Let your arrows make the Danaans pay for my tears shed. So he spoke in prayer, and Phoebus Apollo heard him and strode down along the pinnacles of Olympus, angered in his heart, carrying across his shoulders the bow and the hooded quiver, and the shaft clashed on the shoulders of the god walking angrily. He came as night comes down, and knelt then apart and opposite the ships, and let go an arrow. Terrible was the clash that rose from the bow of, for the bow of silver. First he went after the mules and their circling hounds, then let go a tearing arrow against the men themselves and struck them. The corpse fires burned everywhere and did not stop burning. Okay. So, lots of information. I guess the big question, what's the point of the Iliad? What's the story of the Iliad? What's it about?
Anger.
I feel like it's a bit ridiculous. I just read that all out. But yeah, line one, right? Sing goddess, the anger of Peleus' son Achilles. That's what the Iliad's about. The anger of Achilles. Right there, line one. That's it. Yeah?
Yes, obviously.
There will often be, right? Here we have sing goddess, the anger of Peleus' son. There will be something that kind of pithily sums up the point of the epic, right? The Iliad is about Achilles' anger. And we're going to get all of this poem about it. What things, what sort of thoughts did you have about this epic opening? What sort of things did you chat about?
We were wondering if it was very close to the story of Satan and his angels being cast down, where he says the anger of Achilles and its devastation, which put pain thousandfold upon the Achaeans, hurled in their multitudes to the house of Hades.
Yeah.
So it's very similar theme.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, this idea of, like, people of some sort, like being hurled down, hurled towards... I mean, the rebel angels fall. We hear lots about their fall. They tell us about it. We get told about it later. Yeah, absolutely. Yep. Anything else that you thought was kind of pertinent out of this?
Well, is the invocation... It says, sing, goddess. Is that the muse?
Yep, that's the one. Yep. Yep. So we've got our invocation of the muse. We get an epic simile as well, right at the end. It's the description of Apollo when he comes down. The epic simile is, he came down as night comes down. And knelt then apart. Okay?
Yes, I see.
Okay. So, let's think about the Odyssey. I might not necessarily, like, read the whole thing. I'll probably read the kind of pertinent first paragraph and then... paraphrase some of it for time. So the Odyssey begins, tell me news of the man of many ways who was driven far journeys after he had sacked Troy's sacred citadel. Many were they whose cities he saw, whose minds he learned of, many the pains he suffered in his spirit on the wide sea, struggling for his own life and the homecoming of his companions. Even so, he could not save his companions, hard though he strove to. They were destroyed by their own wild recklessness, fools who devoured the oxen of Helios, the sun god, and he took away the day of their homecoming. From some point here, goddess, daughter of Zeus, speak and begin our story. Then all the others, as many as fled sheer destruction, were at home now, having escaped the sea and the fighting. This one alone, longing for his wife and his homecoming, was detained by the queenly nymph Calypso, bright among goddesses, in her hollowed caverns, desiring that he should be her husband. But when the circling of the years that very year came, in which the gods had spun for him his time of homecoming to Ithaca, not even then was he free of his trials, nor among his own people. But all the gods pitied him, except Poseidon. He remained relentlessly angry with godlike Odysseus until his return to his own country. Okay. We'll pause there. So, the same question for you guys. Like, what's the point? What's the story of the Odyssey? What's the Odyssey about?
Well, is it again that in the first couple of lines, the man of many ways who was... it's about his journey, isn't
it? Yeah.
Yeah.
Odysseus has a terrible journey back from Troy. It takes him 10 years, right? Over 10 years to get from Troy home. In large part thanks to those meddling gods, right?
But they do take pity on him during the course of this section. They argue amongst themselves.
Yes,
and
they do
then realise that he's a good guy, really.
Yes. And another hallmark of epic is meddling gods, and also gods that often fight with each other.
Yes, so is it a hallmark that there's one god, like there is here, who's the meddling one?
You get it in the Aeneid as well. There's one that has a real... You don't want a god to have a grudge against you, as Aeneas and Odysseus suffer as a result. So often there'll be one that particularly dislikes you. Any other thoughts that you guys had about the Odyssey?
It's heroic. Odysseus comes across as heroic.
Yes.
Character.
Yes.
It's very sympathetic.
Yes.
In this. And the gods seem to quite like him, I thought.
Apart from Poseidon.
Yeah. That's the other thing. I guess... definitely in relation to Paradise Lost, very interesting questions about an epic hero. I can't believe I didn't mention it right. All epics will have a hero. Paradise Lost has an interesting epic hero. Because vast swathes of critics think Satan is the epic hero. Milton was of the devil's party, right?
But I think what I've sort of thought about this is you would really need to sit down. Well, I would need to sit down with a pen and paper and just put all these names in and then discover who belonged to who.
Yes.
Because on a reading, you just... I can't get my head around who belongs to who and...
Yeah.
Who's the son of who and whatever.
It's fine. Mine is extensively annotated. I do not have a, family tree in my head of Greek mythology. So working with... Generally having Google up, right? Yeah. And kind of Googling who this person is and writing it down furiously. I mean, equally the same with the earlier poetry, right? The early bits of L'Allegro is just one classical figure after another. Mm. You have to figure out who they are. Mm. Milton knows. That's the point. That's why this is so clever. That's why he's so clever. He knows this.
Knows who's who.
I personally do not carry this in my head. Most people don't.
We wondered line 99 and 100. This powerful spear. Is that an example of ekphrasis, or is it not detailed enough?
Ekphrasis will be really often very, very extensive, to the point where it seems to almost come to life. I'm not sure if there is any ekphrasis in this bit. So if, to find ekphrasis, basically look for an object and then look for 50 lines, right? Where it's being described by the object described. Achilles' shield is extensively described. It has all kinds of things on it, and we hear about all of them. It has people getting married, it has trials going on, it has numerous scenes of farming, of harvest, has the sea, it has the cosmos, and they're all described. That's kind of ekphrasis, and to the point where the description is so vivid it almost feels like it has come to life in some ways. We'll quickly look at the Aeneid, and then we'll think about, then we'll come together and we'll look at Paradise Lost. Okay. So whiz through the opening of the Aeneid, slightly less dense, I think. So, I sing of a warfare and a man at war. From the sea coast of Troy in early days, he came to Italy by destiny. To our Lavinian western shore, a fugitive, this captain buffeted cruelly on land as on the sea by blows from powers of the air. Behind them, baleful Juno in her sleepless rage. And cruel losses were his lot in war, till he could found a city and bring home his gods to Latium, land of the Latin race, the Alban lords and the high walls of Rome. Tell me the causes now, our muse, how galled in her divine pride and how sore at heart from her old wound, the queen of gods compelled him, a man apart, devoted to his mission, to undergo so many perilous days and enter on so many trials. Can anger, black as this prey on the minds of heaven? Tyrian settlers in that ancient time held Carthage on the far shore of the sea, set against Italy and Tiber's mouth, a rich new town, warlike and trained for war. And Juno, we are told, cared more for Carthage than for any walled city of the earth, more than for Samos, even. There her armour and her chariot were kept, and fate permitting, Carthage would be the ruler of the world. So she intended, and so nursed that power. But she had heard long since that generations born of Trojan blood would one day overthrow her Tyrian walls, and from that blood a race would come in time with ample kingdoms, arrogant in war, for Libya's ruin. So the Parcae spun. In fear of this, and holding in memory the old war she had carried on at Troy for Argos's sake, the origins of that anger, that suffering still rankled deep within her, hidden away the judgment Paris gave, snubbing her loveliness, the race she hated, the honours giving ravished Ganymede, Saturnian Juno, burning for it all, buffeted on the waste of sea those Trojans left by the Greeks and pitiless Achilles, keeping them far from Latium. For years they wandered as their destiny drove them on from one sea to the next, so hard and huge a task it was to found the Roman people. Okay, so tell us about the Aeneid then.
Well, there you have it. So hard and huge a task it was to found the Roman people.
Yeah.
It's a serious subject, the founding of a city.
Yeah.
And it starts, I sing of, they all start like this.
Yeah.
And Also there's anger because Juno causes him all this trouble because she's angry.
Yeah.
Because from the judgment.
Yes.
Of Paris. And also the she wanted Carthage to be the city.
Yeah.
The most important city. So she's this anger festers.
Yeah.
So she fights Jupiter over it, or at least she's at loggerheads with Jupiter, and Aeneas suffers because of this.
Yeah.
And the story is of how he overcomes all these difficulties.
Yeah.
And found Rome.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of anger in the verse.
Mm.
There's things like King Aeolus rules the contending winds and moaning gales and warden of their prison. Round the walls they chafe and bluster underground. The din makes a great mountain murmur overhead. It's all very, very dramatic.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And I mean, Virgil writing as a Roman poet, right? He's writing his kind of national, the history of his people.
Yes, yes.
This is kind of like, this is big stuff.
Yes.
This is their national history.
Yes.
Yes. Coming back to this big subject, right? The Trojan War. Interesting, Odysseus's journey, a very famous subject, but not like the founding of Rome.
No.
A little bit of contextual information. Juno is irritated for two reasons. Firstly, she doesn't like the Trojans. She has a thing against the Trojans because Paris didn't pick her.
Mm.
Basically, he was supposed to give an apple to the most beautiful goddess.
Yes.
And he picked... I can't remember who he picked. He didn't pick her, basically.
He picked Venus, but what's the Greek name for Venus? Didn't he?
I can't remember.
Aphrodite.
Yeah. Aphrodite.
So Juno has a thing against the Trojans because of that. She also supports Carthage, which is home to Dido.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I don't know. I was going to say we all know what happens there. Perhaps we don't. Aeneas loves and leaves her,
yeah.
And she kills herself. Mm. She burns herself to death. Mm. Yeah, I know. so that's why Juno doesn't like Aeneas, okay? So how do you feel that... I mean, we've kind of touched on some of it already. Anything particularly kind of epic in terms of... Anything formulaic you noticed?
It's of national importance.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. Invocation of a muse, something of national importance, elevated style. Obviously, we're reading this in translation. That's a big caveat to all of this. Meddling gods,
yes,
big take there.
Yes, yes.
Epic hero. I got one of those as well. Right. Paradise Lost, to finish. The reason we're all here. Is everyone okay to stay for a little bit longer, just to... So, we'll whiz through the first few lines of Paradise Lost, and then we'll think about kind of how this is working within the frameworks that we've looked at so far, and how it's different, okay? So, of man's first disobedience and the fruit of that forbidden tree, whose mortal taste brought death into the world and all our woe, with loss of Eden, till one greater man restore us and regain the blissful seat. Sing, heavenly muse, that on the secret top of Oreb or of Sinai didst inspire that shepherd who first taught the chosen seed, in the beginning how the heavens and the earth rose out of chaos. Or if Sion Hill delight thee more, and Silua's brook that flowed fast by the oracle of God, I thence invoke thy aid to my adventurous song, that with no middle flight intends to soar above the Ionian mount, while it pursues things unattempted yet in prose or rhyme. And chiefly thou, O spirit that dost prefer, before all temples the upright heart and pure, instruct me, for thou knowest thou from the first was present, and with mighty wings outspread, dove-like sat brooding on the vast abyss and madest it pregnant. What in me is dark, illumine. What is low, raise and support. That to the height of this great argument I may assert the eternal providence and justify the ways of God to men. Say first, for heaven hides nothing from thy view, nor the deep tract of hell. Say first, what cause moved our grandparents in that happy state, favoured of heaven so highly, to fall off from their Creator and transgress his will for one restraint, lords of the world besides? Who first seduced them to that foul revolt? The infernal serpent, he it was, whose guile, stirred up with envy and revenge, deceived the mother of mankind, what time his pride had cast him out from heaven, with all his host of rebel angels, by whose aid, aspiring to set himself in glory above his peers, he trusted to have equalled the Most High, if he opposed, and with ambitious aim against the throne and monarchy of God, raised impious war in heaven and battle-proud with vain attempt. Him the almighty power hurled headlong, flaming from the ethereal sky with hideous ruin and combustion down to the bottomless perdition, there to dwell in adamantine chains and penal fire, who durst defy the omnipotent to arms. Okay. So we'll finish there. So, thoughts that people have on and how Milton crafts his epic opening here. What sorts of things are familiar and what sorts of things are different?
He's got the muse.
He has.
I would wonder, was it, is that the Holy Ghost though, rather than a goddess? Would
it is... the muse that he is claiming inspired Moses. The glosses say it's possibly Urania, but here apparently associated with the divine Logos, informing both Moses' prophetic vision on Mount Oreb and the temple worship of Sion Hill.
It isn't.
It says... It carries on to say, boldly ignoring contemporary attacks on invocation. Davenant thought invoking the Holy Ghost in poetry to be saucy familiarity with a true God.
It's just like, with mighty wings outspread, dove-like.
It's epic because in the beginning... how the heavens and earth rose out of chaos. So it's an epic in that sense.
Yeah. And what's the point of Paradise Lost? Absolutely. Yeah, that's it, right? It's about man's first disobedience and the apple that brought death into the world and all our woe. He does later go on to say exactly what he's doing, which is, as I said in the lecture, to justify the ways of God to men. So he nuances it. But yeah, just like all the others, line one, this is the point of the poem. This is what I'm doing. And straight away, it's Christian, right?
Yes.
There is nothing classical to begin with. Very quickly, it drifts that way. He invokes a muse. But right from the start, it's about man's first disobedience. We all know what that is. Everyone would know what that is, right?
It's very lofty. He announces it straight away.
Yes.
With no middle flight, intends to soar.
Yes. Yep. So it's, he says he's pursuing things unattempted yet in prose or rhyme. He's kind of saying, he's saying to the muse, you need to help me. Basically, he's saying to the muse, you need to help me so I can do this. Anything else that you kind of notice about Milton's epic opening?
Well, he repeats invoking the muse just before the lines you've just quoted.
Yeah.
Things unattempted.
He does a lot of invoking. It's quite lengthy. So the bit I've just read, and then it, invoke thy aid to my adventurous song, and then he carries on. What is in me dark, illumine. What is low, raise and support. That to the height of this great argument I may assert the eternal providence and justify the ways of God to men.
Is he asking the muse to help him with the poem?
Yeah. He's asking for the inspiration to be able to... he's basically saying, what's dark inside me that I don't know yet, that I can't grapple with yet, bring to light. Basically raise me up to a position that can do the ultimate thing in many ways and explain kind of what God's intentions are, what God is doing, justify how God works. One thing you need to take away is how ambitious this is, right?
Definitely.
It's ambitious it would be ambitious in the sense that Milton tries to replicate an epic, but it's doubly ambitious because of his subject matter. He's not just kind of, you know, recounting the story of Adam and Eve. He's justifying the ways of God to men, and he sets it out right at the start of the poem. A very upfront, ambitious claim on Milton's part.
Nobody's done this before.
No.
He's the first.
Yeah, he's very keen to make sure everybody knows this. Any other thoughts about Milton here, about what he does?
He talks about what was the cause that moved our grandparents in that happy state, favoured of heaven so highly, to fall off from their creator.
Yeah. So there were all kinds of, I mean, I guess to branch out more broadly, the field of kind of the criticism that surrounds Paradise Lost is really fascinating. And there's lots of debate. I spent a whole term on Paradise Lost when I was an undergraduate. And we had extensive debates about Adam and Eve's free will. The fact that it becomes massively complicated. It becomes massively interwoven with very intricate 17th century theology. It's heavy. All kinds of debates about lots of people sitting there and saying, well, how can Adam and Eve have free will when God, like, has told us, like, right from the start before we even meet them, that they're going to fall? Like, how does that work? Equally kind of interesting, Satan. We kind of touched on it already. Lengthy debate as to who the epic hero of Paradise Lost is. Who should be the epic hero?
God.
No. Who's the epic hero? Who's going to save the day?
Oh, Jesus.
Yeah, the Son.
Of course, yeah.
God is unlikable, often. The Son is okay. Satan, everyone's favourite character.
He's given a real personality in the poem, though.
Yes.
Satan. I mean, when you read it, you have some sympathy.
Yeah, you do.
Yeah.
Yeah. So branching out from epic, I mean, Paradise Lost is massively complicated and fascinating. And you can have, like, you know, a term's worth of debate each week, kind of. Like, when we did it, we did two books a week. So we went through the whole poem and we read two books each week and we talked about what happened in those books for the first 6 weeks. And then we went back and we started again and we took a more thematic approach and kind of looked at it all again. And we still didn't cover everything. So, I guess we're going to have to stop, right? We've overrun slightly. Apologies for keeping you over time. Hopefully you will find it interesting. I wish we had a bit more time to dwell more on Milton. But hopefully, what I was keen for you to see was to see Milton in context with other epic poets. And that's really important when you think about how he works with the ancient world. So.
I think that definitely happened.
Good.
See the big thing, it's finding these little things.
Yes.
It's time.
Yes, yeah.
And study.
I'd encourage you, if you haven't read Paradise Lost, you should read it. If you liked Milton's poetry in those two shorter poems, then you'll like Paradise Lost. The most beautiful expression.
They read it all a couple of years ago. Did you hear it?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. There are lots of audiobooks of Paradise Lost.
You need to read up on the gods first.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Fueled desire to do that.
I got. I haven't read it yet, but for Christmas, Stephen Fry's done Mythos.
Yeah.
So that's a retelling of the kind of Greek myths, I think.
But in a modern context.
I think so.
Might download it on Audible.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm sure it'll be very good. I mean, be very informed. But do have a look at Paradise Lost. It's beautiful and interesting. Yes, thank you. It was lovely to meet you all. Enjoy the rest of the Renaissance.
Thank you for your smashing introduction. Yes. That was fast and full and very good.
Yes. Oh,
yeah. And as you say, you can read it.
It's learning it looks like.
We're not telling you.
So it's very clean.
This rain.
There must be some sort of makeup. Yes. Sure, it'll be brilliant. See you, nice to meet you.
That's all right, as long as everybody enjoys it.